Good afternoon. My name is Matt Woodbury, and I'll be bringing you the first half of the Pantograph News today from the edition dated Friday, April 20th. Let's get started with a story on the first page. This one's titled Teen Safety Paramount During Prom Season. Agencies Encourage Communication, Trust Between Parents and Kids. This is written by Julia Evilsizer. A safe and memorable prom season starts with a trusting relationship between parents and teens, and several Twin City agencies are sharing safety tips before the big night. Before prom, parents should talk to their teens about where they're going, who they'll be with, and the exact plans for the evening. A parent should act as a support person if a child ever feels like they're at risk. They have enough understanding and trust to contact their parent, said Liz Hamilton, Community Project Coordinator with BN Parents. BN Parents, a branch of the Bloomington Normal Community Campus and Committee, is a community-led group that encourages open discussion between parents and teens about substance abuse and overcoming peer pressure. The group is connected with the five largest high schools in Bloomington Normal and provides talking points and safety resources to parents and students on bnparents.org. There's a link to a prom night agreement on the page, which parents and teens can fill out together before prom. It can be personalized and lays out the expectations of the night and consequences if students break the deal, said Hamilton. School resource officers at many local high schools are speaking with students before prom about laws applying to minors and driving safety, especially after the Twin City, Clinton, and Gibson communities experienced recent fatal teen car accidents. The approach this year is to create more open lines of communication for students and parents, said Elias Mendiola, Public Information Officer for Bloomington Police. We want parents to give their children the option to notify us and to know we're available if teens need a ride. Mendiola said students should download ride-sharing apps for Uber, Lyft, and local taxi services in case they need a safe ride home. Teens attending prom also should keep their cell phones charged, he added, and be aware of local curfew laws, with exceptions if a child is leaving a school-sponsored event like prom. The Twin City Police also plan to inform local hotels of prom dates to prevent rentals to underage students. Nearly all Central Illinois high schools also host events for students after the dance, known as after prom, to discourage students from attending parties that can include alcohol and unsafe behavior. On Saturday, more than 600 students attended the Normal Community West High School after prom party, said Dana Brown, co-chair of the event and spokesperson for McLean County Unit 5. We aren't only looking to give students an experience they can look back on with fond memories, we're trying to give them an avenue to continue good decision-making, said Brown. The Normal West After Prom, paid for through parent fundraisers, lasted until 4 a.m. at the high school, where students enjoyed laser tag, inflatables, henna drawing, miniature golf, a photo booth, hypnotist, raffle prizes, and food. A lot of times students have unrealistic expectations for what they think prom should include. By giving them this alternative opportunity, we're showing them prom can be a great experience in a safe and positive environment. Once a student enters an after-prom event, they cannot leave without parental permission, according to school officials. I suggest parents promote participation in after-prom. If a teen does not attend after-prom and will be at a friend's house, we suggest parents make a call to the parents who are hosting to make sure they'll be there and no alcohol will be available, said Hamilton. Hamilton also encouraged community members without teens to take an active role in keeping students safe during prom celebrations by driving vigilantly during the Saturday night dances and keeping an eye out for underage drinking. It takes a community to support a child, especially when they become independent and can drive, said Hamilton. We like to trust that teens always want to make good decisions for themselves. Parents should trust that ability, but always be there to support the teen because sometimes it can be difficult. And next up, we have an article that's titled State Shifts Safety Approach. Lawmakers Consider Therapists Instead of Armed School Officers. Some Illinois lawmakers want to give extra money to schools that replace armed security officers with unarmed social workers and behavior therapists, an approach to safety that's far different than a national push to add police or armed teachers following a mass shooting at a Florida high school. Representative Emmanuel Chris Welch, a Hillside Democrat, said he proposed the plan after hearing from advocates who argue that investing in mental health resources is the best way of treating the epidemic of violence. His plan, which is backed by 16 other Democrats in the House, would allow schools to apply to an optional grant if they promise to reallocate funding for school-based law enforcement to mental health services, including social workers or other practices designed to promote school safety and healthy environments. But the measure could be a tough sell, especially amid a widespread effort to employ more of what's known as school resource officers, fully armed law enforcement officers often paid for by schools. As of early April, 200 bills or resolutions have been introduced in 39 states regarding school safety, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. More than half of these measures were introduced following the events in Parkland, Florida. 34 bills in 19 states address regulations and training for school resource officers. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions proposed a school safety plan in March that included a measure prioritizing grants to states that agreed to use the money to put more law enforcement in schools. Michelle Mabechny-Wiley from the Sergeant Shriver Center on Poverty Law said this approach is wrong-headed and that police are unequipped to recognize or respond to mental health issues. She adds that many minority students within the Chicago public school system are arrested by school resource officers for non-serious offenses, which could jeopardize their chances of applying to jobs and colleges in the future. This increased presence of law enforcement in schools does not necessarily enhance school safety, said Michelle Mabechny-Wiley from Sergeant Shriver Center for Poverty Law. Instead, it dramatically increases the likelihood that students will be unnecessarily swept into the criminal justice system, often for mere adolescent or disruptive behavior. However, advocates for school resource officers argue their role is essential to keep students safe, especially in the event of a school shooting. After Parkland, Deputy Kip Heinel, former president of the Illinois School Resource Officers Association, said he was fielding 2 to 3 phone calls a day from school districts asking how they can add more patrolling officers. While there's no official count on how many school resource officers are employed in Illinois, he puts an estimate at around 500. Heinel, who works as a school resource officer in an Illinois suburb of St. Louis, says he believes the officers are the best line of defense to keep students safe in schools. He adds that beyond preserving law and order in schools, he adds that many officers also act like a mentor and an informal counselor to many of their students, with the goal of shaping them to be successful adults someday. School resource officers are not required to be trained in Illinois, but they can pay to take part in an optional annual training session each summer in Bloomington. Around 85 to 100 officers from around the state typically attend, said Heinel. No Chicago public school officers have ever attended, he added. And our next story is titled, City Says Siam Breached Contract. Managers Accused of Defrauding Taxpayers. This is written by Edith Brady Lunny. Managers of the city-owned arena conspired to defraud taxpayers of commissions owned on food and beverage sales and diverted money intended to operate the financially failing venue to an official's personal bank account, according to counterclaims filed Thursday by the city. Central Illinois Arena Management, or SIAM, is suing the city for at least $67,175 in commissions the city allegedly failed to pay during the time SIAM managed the 7,000-seat venue. The money represents unpaid commissions on revenue from SIAM's sale of sponsorships, advertising, and premium seating, according to the civil action filed in McLean County Court. The lawsuit was filed in November, 2 months after SIAM owner John Y. Butler and 4 other former managers of the arena were indicted on more than 100 counts of theft, money laundering, wire fraud, and tax-related offenses. In a 42-page response and counterclaim filed Thursday, the city laid out specific details of how Siam allegedly withheld funds from the city through a scheme that lasted several years. The 14-count counterclaim accuses Siam of using Coliseum revenue to pay its attorney for corporate expenses, including the renegotiation of the city's 10-year deal with Siam that ended in March 2016. In a statement issued after the court filing, the city said, although the city originally intended to allow the criminal case to be prosecuted in full before determining whether additional civil remedies should be pursued in light of the civil litigation initiated by Siam, the city is now opting to begin pursuit of civil claims against John Butler, Siam, and BMI. Butler's request in late March 2016 for about $247,000 to cover operating expenses, including payroll and utilities, ultimately benefited him when $152,000 of the money ended up in his personal account, according to the filing. The city alleged that only a small portion of a $113,000 utility bill was paid by Siam before the contract ended. The arena officials kept an internal log of illegal discounts on food and beverage sales that shorted the city $34,000 in commissions between 2013 and 2015, states the counterclaim. Butler's side deal with Venue Coalition, a booking agency, cost Siam $1,000 to $2,500 per event under a contract not disclosed to the city that generated payments to Butler, according to the city's allegations. Other alleged misconduct includes the posting of concession equipment by Siam as security for its loans, a pledge the city did not approve. A judge recently dismissed charges against former Siam general manager Bart Rogers, but left open the possibility that the state may refile the 13 theft charges. Still facing charges are Butler, Kelly W. Klein, assistant general manager for finance, J.C. Leish, ex-finance director of BMI Concessions, and Paul Grazer, former food and beverage director for Siam. In March, Judge Rebecca Foley ruled that the lawsuit could move forward. Foley rejected arguments from the city's lawyer, Greg Mordock, that Siam breached the contract by allegedly failing to obtain the city's approval for contracts valued at more than $10,000. The city has denied owing Siam any unpaid commissions. Siam lawyer Travis Quick said the city signed at least one of the contracts, and former city manager David Hales reviewed profit and loss statements that included information on the agreements. The four defendants are free on bond. A July 13th hearing is set to review the status of the case. And in other news, our next story is titled, Turbine Setbacks Okayed. DeWitt County Board Votes Against Height Limits for Wind Farms. This is written by Kevin Barlow. The DeWitt County Board's discussion Thursday night to expand the setbacks around wind farm turbine towers, but not limit their height, pleased a developer proposing such a project, but left some residents unhappy. The board voted 6-5 against implementing a height limit of 499 feet. But it unanimously approved mandating a setback of at least 2,000 feet between a turbine tower and the property of a landowner who is not contracted to host a tower site. That setback is an increase of 500 feet from the current standard. It's a little bit of a mixed bag of emotions, said Andrea Rhodes, whose home sits in the footprint of a project site proposed by Tradewinds Energy. We were very pleased with the 2,000-foot setback, but we were expecting the height to be restricted because currently our ordinances have no height restriction, which means these turbines could be as high as you could imagine, and that's something we're not very keen on, said Rhodes, who was among about 150 people who attended the meeting at the DeWitt County Government Building in Clinton. The Lenexa, Kansas-based development intends to file for a special use permit to build a wind farm centered about 5 miles northwest of Clinton. It would stretch across 24,000 acres and involving about 200 individual landowners. Tom Swierczewski, a development director with Tradewinds Energy, spoke in favor of the board's decisions. The 2,000-foot setback was something we heard pretty clear from the community and the county board members, and it was something we could agree with to accommodate them, he said. But the 499-foot height just doesn't work together with that, he added. It would have been a burden to the project and would have made it tough to compete in the market with those two strict standards. Sworzewski said the company is beginning to narrow its list of turbine types and is looking at towers both taller and shorter than 499 feet. We're looking at which of the machines are perfect for the site, and we will include that when we present our application to the county, he said. Previously, the Regional Planning Commission and Zoning Board of Appeals unanimously recommended the height restriction and the setback expansion. Sworzewski said company officials are looking at filing the special use permit application with the county later this spring. Once the application is filed, the Regional Planning Commission and Zoning Board of Appeals will add their recommendations before it goes to the county board. I hope the board will be open to more discussions from our group and more education, Rhodes said. This is going to be a very long process. In another local news, our next story is titled Owner's Names Requested in Tax Deal. This one's written by Derek Bay. Normal Township sent a simple message Thursday to local landlords asking for a tax deal. Say who you are first. It's public information once you start dealing with us, so make it public, said board member Sally Pine. After student apartment owners refused to cooperate with a new policy making businesses that work with the township publicly list their ownership. The fact that they're making such a deal about it now, I really want to know who's on there, because now it smells bad. In response, the board again tabled agreements that would set taxable values for apartment buildings managed by First Sight and Young America below the value set by Normal Township assessor Rob Cranston. The owners appealed those values and settled with the biggest taxing bodies, Normal-based McLean County Unit 5 and the Town of Normal, but the township and the town and the Normal Public Library Board have refused to settle. Officials remain unclear on what happens if the township and library reject the agreements, which Unit 5 negotiated on behalf of all local taxing bodies. Unit 5 has said the agreements end a costly legal process and bring in new tax money, but critics have said the owners are not paying enough and taking advantage of a broken system. Township Supervisor Sarah Grammer said her board will reconsider the issue only if the owners identify themselves. Almost every property listed in the agreements is owned by a limited liability company, which prevents the public from knowing who benefits from the deals. Officials have said the policy was intended to prevent unintentional conflicts of interest for board members. Board member Ray Ropp said he wants to vote on the agreements because he disagrees with them regardless of who is responsible. I don't believe that we should enable entities to arbitrarily come up with agreements on assessed value, which are not what Cranston provided, he said. Board member Arlene Hosea said she preferred not to vote yet, but added, the process is wrong. I'd like to know who's making the request to undermine the assessor's job, said Pine. I'd like to know who those people are who put themselves ahead of public interest. In other business, the board appointed a new member to replace Samantha Quiggle, who resigned to take a job in Tacoma, Washington. Dana Schickstans, a 41-year-old assistant store manager at Barnes & Noble in Bloomington, will serve the three remaining years on Quiggle's term. Grammer recommended Schickstans among 15 candidates who submitted letters of interest. She said Schickstans is a homeowner, can represent the interests of families and renters who benefit from township assistance. Schickstans holds an Illinois State University government and politics degree. One of the things I took from that is how important local government is to the everyday lives of the people around you, she said. I'm excited to serve. And moving on to other local news with another article that's written by Kevin Barlow, this one entitled, Crash Sends Car Through Fence, No Injuries After Vehicle Damages Playground Barrier. A two-vehicle crash at Washington Elementary School in Bloomington Thursday morning sent one of the vehicles through the school's playground fence. Police said there were no injuries to the drivers and no students were on the playground at the time of the incident. The crash happened at about 9 a.m., about 10 minutes after children went into the school. Police said one man was ticketed for failure to obey a traffic control device. The investigation revealed the driver, whose name has not yet been released, did not stop at a red light, sideswiped another vehicle, and ended up in the fenced-in area. Fortunately, nobody was hurt, and that's the most important thing, said District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley. We're very thankful that we have the fence as a barrier. It's not something that's going to be foolproof, obviously, but it is very common for a vehicle to come through a chain link fence at a particular location. But as everyone knows, the intersection of Washington and Towanda is a very busy intersection at certain times of the day, so safety is always a concern of ours. Following the crash, district officials conferred about both short-term and long-term options, Riley said. When you have an incident like this, it will cause you to review and look at what you have in place, and we will certainly do that, he added. I already had a conversation with our director of facilities about the barrier, and to look at the possibility and feasibility of a barrier in addition to the fence. What that is, I'm not sure at this point. But Washington School has been there for well over 100 years, and to my knowledge, this is the first time something like this has ever occurred. But lightning can strike twice, he said. That's not to say that something like this can't happen again. The last thing I want is for it to happen again, and we have to do our due diligence into looking at every possible way to keep our kids and staff safe. And if you'd like to see a picture of the car going through the chain link fence, you can find that on page A3 of the pantograph. And our next story, written by Lenore Sabota, is titled Deer Captured in McLean, Moved to Rehabilitator. A tame white-tailed deer that has been wandering through residential areas in McLean has been captured and relocated to a wildlife rehabilitator. Jim Schweizer, a spokesman for the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, said the deer was located Wednesday morning in a backyard and wildlife officials received permission from the resident to enter the property. The deer was sedated, put in a crate, and taken to a wildlife rehabilitator, he said. It went very well, according to our biologist who was there, said Schweizer. When they got to the rehabilitator and opened the crate, she bounded into the holding area. The deer appears to be in good health, he said. And the hope is the deer can be rehabilitated and returned to the wild to take care of itself. If that isn't possible, options will be reviewed, said Schweizer. At a public forum earlier this month in McLean, John Greisbaum, an IDNR wildlife biologist, said if the deer could not be released to the wild, it might have to stay in captivity. The location where the deer was taken is not being publicly disclosed, Schweizer said. Conservation Police Officer Matt Graydon said at the public forum, we have to consider the privacy and security of where this deer goes next. The deer, a young doe, is believed to have been hand-raised as a fawn and become accustomed to humans. People at the forum said the deer not only walked up to people, but also showed little fear of dogs. Some residents had been feeding the deer, either directly or by leaving food out. The deer was captured after concerns were raised that it could be injured by a vehicle, could cause injury to others, or that a male deer it might attract during mating season could become aggressive. We just want what's the best outcome for the deer, Greisbaum said at a public forum. Shifting to a bit of national news, we have a story titled Opioid Prescriptions Decline. New data show that the number of prescriptions for opioid painkillers filled in the U.S. fell dramatically last year. They showed their biggest drop in 25 years. The decline comes amid increasing legal restrictions and public awareness of the dangers of addiction. A health data firm released a report Thursday showing a 9% average drop nationwide in the number of prescriptions for opioids filled by retail and mail order pharmacies. All 50 states of the District of Columbia had declines of more than 5%. The U.S. is estimated to consume roughly 30% of all opioids worldwide. Health data firm IQVIA's Institute for Human Data Science released a report Thursday showing an 8.9% average drop nationwide in the number of prescriptions for opioids filled by retail and mail-order pharmacies. All 50 states and the District of Columbia had declines of more than 5%. Declines topped 10% in 18 states, including all of New England and other states hit hard by the opioid overdose epidemic, such as West Virginia and Pennsylvania. We're at a really critical moment in the country when everybody's paying attention to this issue, said Michael Kleinrock, the Institute's research director. People really don't want them if they can't avoid them. There was an even greater drop in total dosage for opioid prescriptions filled in 2017, down 12% from 2016. Reasons for that include more prescriptions being for a shorter duration, a 7.8% decline in new patients starting on opioid prescriptions, and far fewer high-dose prescriptions. Opioid doses are measured in morphine milligram equivalents. A standard Vicodin pill has the equivalent of 5 milligrams of morphine. Prescriptions for dosages of 90 morphine milligram equivalents per day or more, which carry the highest addiction risk, declined by 16% last year, according to the report. The U.S. is estimated to consume roughly 30% of all opioids used worldwide. Opioid prescriptions and daily doses rose steadily during the 1990s, fueled by factors including marketing of new opioid pills such as OxyContin. Use peaked in 2011, at levels far above those in other wealthy countries where national health systems control narcotics more aggressively. The U.S. decline began after overdoses and deaths from prescription opioids and illicit narcotics soared, and multiple groups pushed back. The federal government and about half the states have enacted restrictions such as limiting the dose or duration of opioids that can be prescribed. Insurers and drug stores began imposing similar limits on opioid use for acute pain, as opposed to cancer and chronic pain patients. The Drug Enforcement Administration increased prosecution of heavy prescribers, and numerous medical groups have issued guidelines urging prescribers to offer other pain management options when possible, and to limit doses and duration of opioid prescriptions. And coming back to a state news story, this one, titled Legionnaire's Aid, paid $20,000 a month. The point person Governor Bruce Rauner plucked from his administration to take charge of the Legionnaire's disease crisis at the Quincy Veterans Home is making $20,000 a month in salary, a 69% rise from the official salary in his previous post. Michael Hoffman, senior advisor to the Republican governor for the Quincy response, told a joint hearing of the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committees on Thursday that his personal services contract pays him $20,000 a month. State records indicate he's paid by the Department of Central Management Services, the agency he headed until tapped for a new assignment in March. The committees convened to question Hoffman about progress for replacing buildings on the Quincy campus, where bacteria-laced water has led to the deaths of 13 residents since 2015. Hoffman, who previously said a strategic plan would be ready by May 1st, agreed to deliver a report by April 27th to lawmakers eager to approve a plan before their scheduled May 31st adjournment. The 40-year-old Hoffman joined the state payroll in March 2015 and became CMS director in January 2016, where he made $142,339 annually. He told the Associated Press that he signed a six-month contract with provisions for early termination if necessary. He noted that with employer contributions for his pension, Social Security, and Medicare, and health insurance, his CMS compensation was similar to his current salary. Asked about his new workload, Hoffman said, "I've spent more time in Quincy in the past month than I have with my family, I'll say that." The unusual persistence of the Legionella bacteria in the Quincy Veterans Home called for an unusual response to protect our state's heroes, Rauner spokeswoman Rachel Bold said. Mike Hoffman's contract is equal to his benefits package at CMS. In the next story, titled State Program to Boost Savings for Retirement, Illinois will soon begin a program requiring many employers to help create voluntary retirement savings plans for employees and automatic payroll deductions. Secure Choice could eventually cover 1.2 million Illinois residents, State Treasurer Mike Frikes told the News Gazette. "This dramatically increases the number of people who are saving their own money for retirement," said Frikes, chairman of the seven-member board overseeing the program. "This is not a state-defined benefit program. This is not Social Security. This is giving people the tools they need to invest in themselves so that they have a brighter retirement." Businesses have been operating for 2 years and have at least 25 employees must either create their own retirement plan or participate in Secure Choice, Frikes said at a retirement planning seminar Wednesday. Employers won't be required to contribute to the program or pay a fee to participate. Employees will automatically have a 5% of their income put into a savings account, but they can change that percentage, Frike said. Employees may also opt out of the program. That's going to wrap up the first half of the Pantograph News from the edition dated Friday, April 20th. Stick around, we'll have more of the Pantograph News in a second. My name is Matt Woodbury, and thank you for listening.